Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, thank you for joining us once again. If this is your first time, please make yourself comfortable as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, each week, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, while my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, takes time away from the show, we're bringing in some wonderful guest hosts who, like Matt, are making a positive difference in the lives of others. Today, my guest co-host is Michael Fink. Michael is a co-founder and outreach director for Thero.org. He has extensive experience in marketing strategies for clinics, hospitals, and treatment centers, and is passionate about stigma reduction in the mental health and addiction treatment fields. Now, I'm also looking for some show ambassador listeners who will forward at least one of our shows to your social media groups and or to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. I truly appreciate it, and this is another way we can make a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, Michael, first, I just want to thank you for being here on Answers for the Family and share with us a little bit about what is Thero.org exactly.
Well, thank you, Alan. It's an honor to be on the show. Thero.org, in kind of the most succinct way I can put it, is a nonprofit community of treatment providers who are building a truly comprehensive national mental health resource directory. So that looks like everything from psychologists to psychiatrists to treatment centers, crisis lines, advocacy organizations, nonprofit organizations. You name it. We want to be kind of a hub for anything and everything mental health. And there's really two parts to Thero. There's the publicly facing resource directory, which is it's free, and it's ad free, it's distraction free. We don't believe in monetizing the public's attention. But then there's also a private online back end network for clinicians to communicate, collaborate, and connect. Because there doesn't really exist a platform like that as it stands now, and they can post and search for referral requests, also promote therapy groups. They can even post office space or job postings as well, so if that makes sense. So
yeah, no, it makes perfect sense, and it's actually one of the reasons why I wanted to get you on the show as soon as possible was to really thank you and your team of mental health professionals for providing the pro bono sessions for those affected by the recent shooting in Las Vegas. So share with our listeners about what the Affordable Therapy Project is.
So the Affordable Therapy Project is an initiative within Thero that we launched. And one of the big pieces to our mission of Thero is to connect people to mental health help. About 60 to 70% nationwide of those who meet criteria for a mental health disorder don't seek help. And so our big mission with the Affordable Therapy Project was to make therapy more affordable. And affordability happens to be one of the biggest impediments to people seeking help. It still is the number one actual impediment to people seeking help. So, the inspiration for the project came out of recent discussions with providers in Charlottesville, Virginia, who found it difficult to mobilize a response to victims of the two white supremacist rallies this past summer. And so the Affordable Therapy Project specifically really focuses on survivors of national crises, victims of natural disasters, and high-risk populations. And those high-risk populations can look domestic violence, first responder traumas, incest and rape survivors, and so on. And Las Vegas attack is just another one of many that we've seen this year. And so in those particular populations, it's even higher. So the extent to which they seek help is even lower than the average, which is around 60% nationwide. So our goal, again, with Thero is to, one of our big goals is to connect people to help. The Affordable Therapy Project does that directly by collaborating with mental health professionals willing to provide pro bono sessions to survivors of these national crises, victims of natural disasters in high-risk communities.
Now, I know that our listenership is made up a large portion of, there are parents of at-risk youth, but there is also a huge amount of professionals out there. So I think the main question is, how can we help, either as a professional or as someone who just is very thankful that there is someone like yourself in an organization like this that is going out there and helping these people in need?
Sure, yeah. There's a couple ways. You know, on our website at thero.org, you can donate, and there's a donation button at the bottom of every page. Thero.org/donate is also a way to access that page. If you're a professional and would like to sign up, a licensed provider that would like to offer a pro bono service, you can go to thero.org/signup, and you can go ahead and list your business in our directory for free. And then when providers want to offer those free sessions for a specific cause or group, they can let people know by selecting the pro bono option. And so those are the two main ways people can help. And right now we're doing a coordinated media push to try and raise as much public awareness of the project as possible, because we've got a wealth of therapists that are willing, mostly in Las Vegas and Los Angeles, that are willing to offer their services pro bono. So at this point, we're really trying to do a coordinated media push to make the public aware that these resources exist and connect those providers to the public, and particularly the survivors of the Las Vegas attack.
All right. Well, that sounds good. And so if you're out there, if you are tied to the media in some way, be it radio, television, go to thero.org and contact them and say, hey, we want to help get this information out there, because, again, that's really what it's all about, is being able to get the information out so more people are aware of the fact that they can get help in these times of need. So, again, I want to really thank you for that. Now, our topic today is a very interesting one. It is narcissism. And I know that when we think of narcissism, we think of a flagrant self-regard that distorts relationships, and that, given the grandiose view of oneself and one's abilities, consumes all the oxygen in the room, almost any room. So, but according to our guest, there is a more subtle version of narcissism that is far more rampant. Now, joining us to discuss her new book, Everyday Narcissism, Yours, Mine, and Ours, is Nancy Van Dyken, a licensed psychologist and licensed independent clinical social worker in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She specializes in counseling individuals, couples, parents, and teens with depression and anxiety, and has helped people heal relationships of all kinds for over 30 years. And Nancy is also a trainer and speaker at workshops, seminars, and conferences, where she shares her wisdom and passions for healing relationships. Nancy, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I've had a chance to read the book, and I've got to tell you, it was quite an eye-opener. So I think one of the first things that would be great to share with our audience, which, again, as we were just saying, is made up of quite a few professionals within the field, is what is the difference between clinical narcissism and everyday narcissism?
Well, the narcissism that people generally throw around quite easily is mostly concerned with a personality disorder form of narcissism, where, as you said, individuals want to be the center of attention. They struggle with someone challenging them, accusing them of being wrong. They always have to be right, perhaps quick to temper. But that's not what I'm talking about at all. I'm talking about everyday narcissism that affects you and me and your listeners out there, because of five core beliefs that we are taught beginning under the age of five that drive our behaviors, emotions, and thoughts for the rest of our lives. And these core beliefs or lies, which are reinforced daily and everywhere, create a great deal of hardship, heartache, and wounding. The good news, and this is what's really important, is all those wounds can be healed. And that's what my book is about, is to name the wounds and then to begin to give people tools on how to heal those wounds. So it's a garden variety form of narcissism. It's not your more severe end of it. I would also say that people who are narcissistic are wounded. So whether it's everyday narcissism, and we have these classic woundings that we all go through, to the very extreme narcissists, they're just incredibly wounded people. They're not bad or evil, but people certainly like to kind of think of them that way.
Nancy, this is Michael Fink. Can you explore that a little bit? I would love to hear a little bit more about that woundedness and what that exactly looks like. Is that kind of a cohesive sense of self that they lack, or what does that woundedness, is that a complex developmental kind of trauma, or what exactly do we mean by woundedness in that context, if you don't mind me asking?
I call it hazy trauma.
Okay.
And so let me give you an example. I have five core beliefs. The first belief is that we are told we have the power and the responsibility to control how other people feel and behave. So, for example, with that myth, the five-year-old is told to go give grandma a hug and kiss goodbye, because that's how families say farewell in this family. And Nancy says, I don't want to. I'm mad at grandma. She just hurt my feelings, and I don't want to. And mother replies with, now go give her a hug and kiss goodbye or she'll feel bad. So now Nancy is five, and she's being told she's responsible for how her 65-year-old grandmother is feeling and that she has the power to control that. And then myth three is, your needs are more important than mine. So what Nancy learns in that incident is that it doesn't matter that Nancy is hurt or that Nancy is angry. What matters is that grandma isn't hurt, and so I have to go give her a hug and kiss goodbye. Hmm. What most kids also learn is that if they don't do that, then mother's going to be irritated and make some comment about, now go do that, Nancy, or she's going to feel bad. Now go give grandma a kiss goodbye. Nancy's already learned by the age of five that if mother is upset by what she's doing or not doing, dad's going to be upset. So now she's in control of these three adults, their behavior and their feelings, and she's only five, and she simply doesn't count. Now, Freud said our basic drive in life was to belong. My main was sex. And Adler broke away in about 1918 and said, no, our major drive in life is we want to belong, we want to fit in, we want to be loved and part of a community. And so as a young child, of course, that need is a very powerful need. And so if I get rejected or someone gets mad at me because I don't go give grandma a kiss goodbye, I'm not going to threaten that sense of belonging. And so I will go do it, and I will start to learn that I just don't matter.
So, Nancy,
I have to follow all these. Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm just going to say, so in that example of with the grandmother, what would you suggest that the parent in that situation do? How should they handle that particular situation so that they're not sort of spreading that myth to the child that they're responsible for grandma's mood or behavior?
Well, I think it's always important to treat people with respect and kindness. So I would encourage Nancy to go up and say, well, it's okay if you're upset with grandma and you don't want to give her a hug and kiss goodbye, but you need to go up to her and say goodbye, grandma, just out of respect for someone who's visited our home. You need to go up and say goodbye.
Okay.
That's how I'd respond.
So
it's cut.
Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking of a client of mine who's a teacher. And he got about halfway through the book before he came to his next session. And he said, Nancy, this everyday narcissism is everywhere. I said, yes, I know. And he said, well, I was at school, and a fifth grader came up to a teacher and said, Mrs. Johnson, I don't have my math done for today. And he heard the teacher say, oh, Johnny, I'm so sorry. I'm so disappointed you don't have your math done. So the teacher is implying that the student is responsible for making the teacher feel disappointed. And it's not really the student's job to make sure the teacher isn't disappointed. But we do teach that. So when the student came into his classroom and he told him he didn't get his homework done, he just looked at him and he said, Johnny, that really concerns me, because what we're going to learn today in math is going to be based on what we learned yesterday. So I'm concerned it's going to be difficult for you today. We're going to have to find a way to make sure you get yesterday's homework done so you can catch up today. So one sends a message of caring and what we can do moving forward, and the other one is shaming. To say I'm disappointed in you is one of the most, in my point of view, damaging things you can say to a child. And we've all said it, or many of us have said it, because it was said to us and it was said to our parents. And it's really important that I send the message that I know people are trying to be the best parents they possibly can be. But it was taught to us, as it was taught to our grandparents, as it was taught to their parents. So it just gets passed on generationally.
Sure. So in some sense, Nancy, it's incumbent upon the individual, the teacher in this sense, to model a certain type of behavior, to frame it a certain way, in order to kind of eliminate the possibility that it's you know, I guess, does that make sense?
Yes, and what I try to stress in my book is that our wounds get triggered all the time by other people. And our tendency, myth two, is, well, if I'm busy making you happy, then by George, you're supposed to be busy making me happy. And if you don't, I'm going to let you know. Hmm. And so the teacher was in myth two, telling the student, you know, your job is to make me happy, and you just disappointed me. So I think what we need to do is heal our own wounds, because you hear it often enough that your needs and wants don't matter. You hear it often enough that you're not lovable enough unless you take care of everybody else on the planet. You get pretty wounded. So as we heal our wounds, then we stop creating wounds in other people.
Yeah,
and it's really important we don't judge ourselves. Yeah.
No, and I think that makes perfect sense from the standpoint that we need to focus on ourselves. Now, going on the basis that most of us that are listening have already gone through being raised, so if we did take on some of these myths, as many of us have, we already have it instilled in us. So what advice would you give to someone who may have bought into the myths in the past and now doesn't really trust the messages that they're getting from their own body?
Okay, those are a couple good questions. One is, the obvious would be is if you read my book, you would get skills and tools to heal the wounds that you've been given. The second thing is that we need to start to listen to the wisdom in our body. But we are so trained out of listening to that wisdom that we create our own unhappiness as we age. For instance, one of the hardest assignments that I might give somebody is to say, please, someone makes a request of them and they say, no, that won't work for me. One of the hardest things for clients to do is to count their needs, count what works for them, and to say no, because we are so fearful of being seen as uncooperative and unlikable and not a team member. So we have to put our needs on the shelf because we so badly want to belong. It might take one of my clients 3 months to say twice a week, no, that won't work for me. We're so used to saying yes, and then it might be a minute later or it might be 3 days later that we connect with our own body that says, what the heck did I agree to that for? Man, I don't want to do that. So it takes time to learn to listen to that wisdom, because we've been trained not to. If we want to belong, we've been trained not to listen to that wisdom within ourselves.
So Nancy, it sounds like there's a strong sense of boundary learning that needs to happen there, and I'm curious what that looks like when you juxtapose that to, you know, kind of making connections with other people, which I think is an important part of you know, life. And I think that's kind of what I wanted to ask you in the next question. What forms the foundation of everyday narcissism? But to juxtapose kind of the boundary setting, but then at the same time making those intimate meaningful connections with other people that are kind of form the foundation of I think happiness.
Absolutely. Good question. Yes, I have a whole chapter on boundaries in my book, and how we've learned not to have them. But if we don't speak our truth, there's also a chapter on how we're taught how to lie. For some reason, they're called little white lies, and that makes it okay. But every time we're not honest, we disconnect in a relationship. So I talk about the importance of honesty with graciousness and to set our boundaries with honesty and graciousness. So if someone says to me, let's go out to dinner, and I say, good idea. How about if we go to this Thai restaurant over here? I could go, oh man, I don't want to go to a Thai restaurant. I don't like Thai food. Or I can say, you know, I really don't care to go to Thai food. However, I really want to go out to dinner with you. How about a Mexican restaurant? Or how about a Greek restaurant? Or what other kind of restaurant would you like to go to? So I add the connecting piece when I say no, which is, I do want to spend time with you. I want to help you if I can. How many listeners, and including ourselves, when someone at work has asked us to help them, and we say yes, and then we go, doggone it, I'm so far behind myself. Why did I say that? Better to say, Sue, I'd really love to help you. However, I'm buried myself. However, if I get my work done today, I'll come to you and see if you still need some help, because I would like to help you out.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're saying is to find a balance, because, I mean, if you just blurt out no and you don't do anything with anyone else, you're sort of isolating yourself. But at the same time, if you just say yes, you're constantly doing for them and not really taking care of yourself. So I think for all of us,
it
would be finding that balance of making sure that you take care of yourself, but at the same time, we are people, as you've said, that we do have a need to belong. We have a need to be loved or to be liked. So it would be find that balance.
Exactly. And I always say, if you listen to your truth and you speak with graciousness and kindness, that there usually won't be a problem in the relationship. However, if you have spent many years taking care of everybody and ignoring yourself, and you start to say no, some people will go away. It's true, because they want you to take care of them. However, what I have found is that my friends want me to give them the truth. How many years did I spend when making a decision with a friend saying, now, you sure we don't have to go to this restaurant? We could go to this other restaurant if you'd prefer. I really don't care. Or, you know, we don't have to go to this movie, because I'm not trusting that they're being honest with me. So when you're honest with people, there will be people who are grateful for that they don't have to second guess what you want and how you feel. And those are the people that are your true friends. There will be people that won't like it. There will be people that go away. But the people that hang around are your real friends. They're the ones who really like you for you, and not just what you can do for them.
Sure, and Nancy, I guess dovetailing off of that, do you believe, you know, that everyday narcissism can encourage resentment, and what relationship does that play? What between those two?
That's a good question. Yes, if I don't speak my truth and I don't keep my boundaries, I get resentful. And I might think of things like, after all I've done for you, the least you could do is this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that so much to ask of you? I've given in to you. The least you could do is do that for me once in a while. So, yes, absolutely, the bitterness can come in, the martyrdom can come in. And if anyone lived with a martyr, which I did, and I vowed I wouldn't become one, and then I became one. And I've been resigning from that position for several decades now. They're no fun to be in a relationship with.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, I know earlier you spoke a little bit about, you know, about lying. And in the book, you know, you write quite a bit about that, that many people lie to survive. Why do you think we do this? And give some examples.
Well, belonging is paramount in our lives, I believe. And so I have a very capable 38-year-old man who has a degree in electrical engineering. And he was terrified to tell his dad he didn't want to work for his company anymore. And he told his dad that he wasn't going to work for his company anymore, but his dad kept calling him back when he had engineering problems. And my client had a really, really hard time saying no to him. In fact, it took him 9 months to say no. So his lie was that he went and helped when he didn't want to help.
Mm-hmm.
I write in the book about the lie of omission. Lots of times we lie by what we don't say. And I say a great example of that is ask the man whose wife has had an affair. It isn't what she said that was the lie. Yes, people went out after work and had dinner and blah, blah, blah. But what she didn't say is that she and John then went out and went dancing and got a motel room. And so what we don't say can be as much of a lie and a disconnect as just a point blank lying about something I want to do or I don't want to do. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I answered your question, though.
No,
did I?
Well, I think you did.
Okay.
Okay. And but now, does this kind of lying also include lying to ourselves?
Yes. And that, of course, is the greatest lie of all, is not being honest with ourselves. I work a lot with women who are in abusive relationships, emotional and or physical, financial, spiritual abuse. And in order to stay, they have to live in a fantasy of what could be. That's one of the greatest lies that goes on. It's a fantasy of what our relationship could be, rather than living in what's really going on today and where's the cancer in the relationship and what do I need to address? What do we need help with? The lie of the addict who minimizes and rationalizes and deny. Great example of how lying to ourselves. A very common lie is, I don't matter. I had a woman that I saw earlier this morning who's in daycare. And in Minnesota, if you're late to pick up your kids from daycare, they charge you by the minute, and they charge you a chunk of change, like $5 a minute.
Wow.
Because they want their day to end. And people don't want to have to pay, you know, a lot of money if they're 5 minutes late. But she hasn't done that. And so we were talking about her lack of boundaries and the lack of care for herself. And she said, yes, I always want to be seen as reasonable. I want to be seen as reasonable and flexible, and then people will like me. So that's her lie to herself, that she doesn't matter. Just the people who are coming to pick up their kids matter, but not her.
Right. Well, we are talking about the term narcissism. Our guest is Nancy Van Dyken, and my co-host is Michael Fink. Now, we're going to take a break. We will be right back. Stay with us. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585. Or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
All right, we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. My co-host is Michael Fink, and we are talking about narcissism with the author of Everyday Narcissism, Yours, Mine, and Ours.
So, Nancy, in the book, you talk about distractors, victim energy being one of them. What are, for our listeners, what are the four biggest distractors as you see them and speak to them in the book?
Fear, the need to belong, victim, and anger. And they're all ways that we avoid feeling what's really going on.
I see.
Victim energy is everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. And a victim is someone who's powerless and really has no choices. Most of us as adults are not victims, but we see ourselves as victims all the time. It happens on the highway when we're mad that that person has pulled in front of us and taken those 10 feet in front of us that belong to us.
Sure.
And we get mad at the server in the restaurant who's not bringing our check or our coffee fast enough. We feel like a victim of our spouse who isn't following the myths because they're supposed to make us happy and they're not. And victim energy, the nice part about victim energy is you can recognize when you do it because people whine. Now, if you want to know about whining, some great examples are professional sports. Just watch those people. They scrunch up their face and they whine, and I didn't cause that foul. I can't believe I got it. Or listen to Washington, D.C. right now. There are a lot of whiners on Capitol Hill.
Sure.
Well, it's everywhere. And because it's everywhere, we have lots of permission to whine. So when anybody complains, gossip, whines, goes into poor me, they're in victim energy and they're not taking responsibility for the choices that they're making that's created this life. The nice thing is once you take responsibility and step out of victim, you start being in control of your life.
Nancy, I think I've come up with the name of your next book.
Okay.
Yeah. Narcissism and Whining in Politics.
I wouldn't touch that one with a 10-foot pole.
I'll bet it'd be a bestseller because you'd certainly have a lot to work with.
Yeah.
So now one of the areas that you talk about in the book is shame. So share with our listeners a little bit about how shame, is an outcome of everyday narcissism.
Well, a definition of shame that I've clung to is a sense of feeling worthless, exposed, other people have now seen it, and feeling vulnerable to more rejection and more put downs and more shaming. So vulnerable, exposed, and worthless all at the same time. It's that feeling of getting red in the face or embarrassed or wanting to disappear into the wallpaper. Now, like the 5-year-old who wanted to count and not give her grandma a kiss and a hug goodbye, what she learned, and it was one paper cut, what she learned is who she was just wasn't important enough. How she felt just didn't matter. Now you get that's one paper cut. And then you hear it again, and you hear it again. A boy who wants to play football and his dad insists on soccer because that's what dad liked. The mother who wants her daughter to be a great dancer. And in fact, she's not interested at all, but she has to do it to please her mother. Every time we're not counted as children, we get a sense of shame, and I describe it as a paper cut. And as you know, I'm assuming you've had a paper cut, they really hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And you get one paper cut after another after another, and pretty soon you got a pretty sizable wound. So a common wound that leads to shame is not feeling listened. See, that Nancy didn't feel like she was listened to. And so when you get in a relationship and your partner isn't listening to you, that wound gets triggered and people can get really angry. You're not listening to me. Now, that wound is very old, but that the scab is being picked off that wound, so a lot of anger can come out. But it's related to the shame. We build self-esteem by people counting us, listening to us, caring about how we feel, and those five myths just keep telling us we don't matter. We're not lovable as we are. We have to follow those lies, those myths, and then we'll become lovable. One of the things I've said to so many of my clients is, have you ever raised a puppy? And they say yes. Did your puppy ever do it wrong? Pee on the floor, chew your favorite chews. Did you stop loving them because they made a mistake? No. But so many of us get afraid to make mistakes because we won't love them.
Sure.
And so we're afraid to let people see who we really are. And that's shame-based.
Sure. And Nancy, that kind of dovetails nicely and segues into the question that I had next, which is what impact does everyday narcissism have on our relationships? And I, you know, you gave a great example there. Are there any other kind of concrete examples that you have that are maybe a little different in scope, but where everyday narcissism does have an impact on our relationships in other ways?
It's huge. Because you see, when you understand everyday narcissism, what somebody does, you totally understand it has nothing to do with you. So, if someone gets mad at you, I had a client whose daughter got mad at her because she didn't make the mashed potatoes right. If you loved me, you'd make the mashed potatoes the way I like the mashed potatoes. Well, the mother made the mashed potatoes the best she could. In fact, her son-in-law helped her figure out, are they whipped up enough? Are they moist enough? And they both decided yes. The daughter, however, said, if you love me, you'd make them more moist. You would remember. But you see, how the mother made the mashed potatoes had nothing to do with the daughter. But the daughter decided it was about her. And so she got really hurt. So when people can start to understand that what other people do has nothing to do with you, mm-hmm. I rarely get hurt anymore. I might be sad by something that happens or disappointed that something's happened, but I rarely get hurt anymore because the wounding is healed and I understand what others do is about them. So many abused women take on the responsibility, well, if I'd had dinner on the table, my husband wouldn't have gotten mad and shoved me into the glass table. Well, if I kept the kids quiet while he was trying to watch a movie, then my husband wouldn't have gotten so mad and sent the kids to bed at 6:30. You see, what we do with our anger is because of decisions that we have made. It isn't because of what anybody else has done.
Mm-hmm.
So my father was a man who I heard him get upset with me once when I started to do something dangerous around the table saw. And all he said in a firm voice was, Nancy? Otherwise, I never heard my dad get angry. And I was 38 years old when he died.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other people who decide it's okay to express their anger. They decide it's okay to call names. They decide it's okay to swear at people and make nasty comments. That's because of the decision that someone has made about how they're going to handle their anger. So when somebody gets mad at you and isn't kind to you, that is not about you. It's about that person and how they decide to handle their disappointment or their anger or their sadness. Does that make sense? Am I making sense?
No, it makes perfect sense, and it's actually one of the things that I can recall telling my own children. You know, when they would come home and say that, you know, Bobby said this or Betty said that or whatever. And, And I would say, well, is that true? And they'd go, no. And I said, so does it speak more about you or does it speak about them? And they'll, you know,
right.
they think about it, and they're, and I said, well, if it's not true for you, and then, you know, I let them fill in the blank at that point. But I think you bring up a great point,
yeah.
is that when somebody loses their mind, you know, over something, you know, you just kind of step back and kind of look at it and go, wow, I wonder what they're going through. Because it certainly isn't an accurate,
yeah.
it isn't accurate about me, so maybe they're going through something.
Yes, I had a very dear friend who had recommended her friend, we'll call her Susie, wanted to get hooked up in a date with Mark. And this woman said, sure, I can hook you up, blah, blah, blah. He's a good friend. He's a really nice guy. I think you'd like him. And so once she found out that the two of them had made a date, all of a sudden she realized that, oh my gosh, I'm not sure. I think I want to date him. So since she and Mark had been good friends for like 30 years since they were in high school, she called Mark and said, hey, I'm just realizing I'd like to date you, but I want to go with who you want to date. Would you like to go out with Susie or would you like us to start going out? And he said, well, really, I'd love to go out with you. Now, Susie took personal affront to this. Now, she's not really ever gone out on a date with this guy or hardly talked to him at all. But she got so angry and so hurt and so disappointed that she's not going to go out with this guy, that she called the friendship off. And they'd been friends for 20 years. And the woman was feeling so guilty and so bad because her friend was rejecting her. And I said, that's not about you. That's about how she's perceiving what happened. You were very gracious to all three of you. That's about, she doesn't even know this guy. And she's in tears and she's crying and she's angry. That's not about you. That's about her and her, maybe it was her fantasy. Maybe it was her belief that this is how women always treat each other. But it isn't about you because you handled it very graciously. But we take that stuff on as if it's about us. And that's because of those five myths, those five lies.
Well, and one of the things that I just looked up, and we've got about probably about 7 minutes or so left, but I know that you talk quite a bit in the book about forgiveness. So share a little bit about, you know, why is forgiveness, meaning everyday forgiveness, so important, and how do people misunderstand what forgiveness is really about?
Well, one of the things years ago, I've had people who've partners have had affairs and they've really had a hard time moving into forgiveness. And there's a variety of reasons for that. But I sent one of my clients to this person who specializes in forgiveness. And she came back and she still was mad as heck at her husband. So I started looking at what is that about? I believe that forgiveness is not possible when our heart is closed. And our hearts are trained to be closed at a very young age. We're not trained how to deal with our sadness and our hurt, our sense of not belonging, our sense of being unimportant. And so we go to anger, a great distractor. If I'm angry, I get hurt, I get angry, I feel disappointed, I get angry. And so our hearts are closed, which makes forgiveness absolutely impossible. So part of the book is about learning to name your feelings and then to start to take care of the feelings that come up. Without forgiveness, you have to keep replaying the story of how poorly you were treated. You have to stay in victim. To not forgive is to stay in victim of how horrible someone's been to you. And by nature, I think anger dissipates. So to keep that non-forgiveness from flowing in, or the forgiveness from flowing in, we have to keep reminding ourselves how terrible those persons that person treated us, or those people treated us, and we have to keep that anger energy moving. It will dissipate by nature if we allow it, but then we have to be willing to feel our hurt and our disappointment and our embarrassment and whatever other feelings are going on.
Sure. Now, Nancy, this concept of everyday healing in your final chapter, you address. Would you mind explaining exactly what do you mean by everyday healing?
Well, I think it's a process of using the tools to heal our own wounds, which means we have to be willing to feel them and learn to take care of them and to own them as ours. It requires living in present time, requires not writing stories, the three Buddhist beliefs, non-attachment. But we need to do it on a daily basis.
So it's a practice of sorts.
And it takes a... Go ahead.
It's a practice of sorts.
It's a practice, yeah. And it's a practice of using the tools that are given in the book. The thing that happens is when you use those tools, at least what I have found is freedom. I just feel free to be me without worry and angst of how somebody else is going to feel or respond. My job in my value system is to be kind and gracious and respectful. How you interpret what I've done, I can take no responsibility for, but I'm fully responsible. And when I live that way and I heal these wounds, and there's a lot of freedom to just be who I am, the gifts that I came in to give.
And, you know, Nancy, when I got to the last chapter, one of the things that I really felt about it was, as I was reading it, and I was reading it alone, but I thought, what a great thing to read with the one that you love, as something that if two people were reading this together that are in a relationship, I think that it would be, you know, rather than one person reading it and then telling somebody else, well, look, I read about this and you need to be doing this or I need to be doing that.
But I
got this feeling, you know, and I'm reading it, you know, trying to get ready for the show. But I thought how nice this would be to be, you know, sitting out on the grass somewhere and reading it with a loved one and then being able to talk about it openly about, you know, well, sometimes I feel like this or sometimes, you know, the other person says, you know, they feel a certain way. Was that part of your intent when you were writing that, or is that just kind of the way that it came out?
Well, certainly when I do couple work, I do a lot of teaching of these tools. And yes, if couples will read it together, and I have given that homework, you start to have the same language and you start to develop the same skills. And so it's very common, you know, if you point a finger at somebody, you got one finger going out and you got three coming back at you.
Yep.
And I always say that's what you always want to focus on, not what the other person is doing, but how do I feel, what do I want, what I need, and that's what you got to speak about, not what they're doing, not what they're doing wrong, not what they should be doing, but how do you feel when they do it that way. And as I said in my book, a lot of people say I feel, and then they give you a thought. I feel that you shouldn't do blah blah blah. Or I feel like it would be better if... Those aren't feeling words. It really means getting good at the vocabulary at the back of my book, listing your feelings every day on what it's like to be you, so you can learn to really tune into your heart, because that's where your wisdom is. Your wisdom is in your heart, and then it has to be filtered through your mind. So we can't just have emotions running rampant, but they have to be filtered.
Sure.
So, perfect for couples to do. Absolutely.
Now, Nancy, as far as, you know, we may have kind of touched on this earlier, but as far as diving a little deeper into kind of who would most benefit by reading your book, and then, in addition, you know, where can listeners go for more information about the book?
Well, I think everybody ought to read that book, because I think most of the population has everyday narcissism.
Sure.
I think that's just pervasive, and it's impacting all sorts of relationships, to ourselves, to our coworkers, to our partners, to our children, to our in-laws, everywhere. You can find me and the information on the book at nancyvandyken.com or healingrelationships.com. It's in Amazon, Barnes and Noble. If you Google the book, it's at a number of places. I know Amazon, though, has an audio and a Kindle book that you can buy as well.
Well, Nancy, I want to thank you very much. The time has flown by. But again, so for everybody out there, the book is Everyday Narcissism, Yours, Mine, and Ours. I think that it's going to open up a lot of eyes for people that read it. So again, I want to thank you for coming on and really acknowledge you for talking about something that maybe a lot of people weren't that comfortable with. But I think you've really nailed it. So again, thank you.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. And Mike, I want to thank you for coming on. And again, for everybody out there, and especially those of you that are professionals in the helping fields, thero.org, check it out. It's something that can be very beneficial, either from the standpoint of your practice or just from the standpoint of being able to offer up some of your time to help a lot of people out there that could really use the help when they're going through a traumatic time.
Thank you very much, Alan.
All right. And for everybody, again, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.